From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Cannes Film Festival gets underway next week, and Quentin Tarantino's latest movie will have its world premiere there. We'll hear what else is in the festival lineup. Then Darcy Carden talks about playing Janet on The Good Place and what it was like to have to portray the characters of all her castmates in one episode this season.
We did do one rehearsal where they were there, and oof, it was just like, it gives me the chills just to think about it. It was just like, felt embarrassing to do Jamila's British accent in front of her or any of their little weird quirks.
All that coming up on today's edition of The Frame. The Cannes Film Festival gets underway next week. Beyond all the glitz and glamour, it's serious business for the filmmakers whose movies are debuting there. One of them is Quentin Tarantino, who has the world premiere of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Our friend Kyle Buchanan, the carpetbagger columnist from the New York Times, is headed to Cannes, and before he packed his bags, he joined me in studio to talk about what he's looking forward to seeing. But I began by asking Kyle whether the festival is still at odds with Netflix.
Well, I mean, is the fight between the festival and Netflix? I would say the festival's kind of caught in the crossfire between French distributors that say Netflix is impinging on their ability to do business, which, you know, they have a lot stricter standards there in France, but it gets to something that we're dealing with in the American film industry too, which is how do you preserve the theatrical experience? Well, Netflix is completely changing the game. This year, yes, there are no Netflix films in competition or outside of it for that matter, because distributors were really sort of putting pressure on Cannes to not program them. That doesn't mean that Netflix can't come in and swoop up some of these films after they become successful at Cannes, which is what happened last year. And I expect we'll see that again this year.
Cannes is also a big market, and there are a lot of films that get sold there. And it does feel, too, that other film festivals like Sundance and Telluride are starting to show a lot more episodic programming. Feels like Cannes is kind of kicking and screaming into this. They're going to show a couple of episodes from Nick Reffin's new series.
I think they're willing to show them if you are a Cannes-vetted filmmaker, and it's an, you know, what could be perceived as a more auteurist, stylistic piece of television. But yeah, I mean, Cannes is the old guard. In a lot of ways, that's wonderful. It feels, you know, part of tradition when you're there in your tuxedo on the steps of the Grand Lumiere. But in a lot of ways, the festival, like Hollywood itself, has got to contemporize.
Cannes has what we can agree is a pretty poor track record when it comes to programming movies directed by women. This year, four female directors will have their work shown in the main competition. It doesn't seem like a lot, but it's certainly an improvement from past years.
Yeah, it's one more than they had last year. Can a lot of the time to get there, you've got to be a veteran filmmaker of a certain stature. And so you see a lot of older male filmmakers there, a lot that frankly have already peaked. That said, Cannes is able to give its imprimatur to directors that are at the beginning of their career. And I think it's important that they start doing that with female filmmakers. They've proved surprisingly averse, and it's not as though they aren't out there. One example is the Sundance Film Festival invests in female directors like Deborah Granik, who did Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace, and sometimes those movies that appear at Sundance that are directed by women make their way to Cannes as a second stop, but Cannes doesn't seem interested in grooming the careers of these women from the get-go, and I think they've got to change that.
I want to talk about some intriguing filmmakers who are showing work at Cannes. One of them is Terrence Malick, who has made a German-language World War II film, and Werner Herzog, who is probably best known for documentaries, who's made a Japanese-language narrative film.
Yes, there's also some bigger titles. You know, last year there was Black Klansman at the festival, Spike Lee's film, and this year is not Spike Lee's best friend, but another famous filmmaker of that level, Quentin Tarantino, with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
It's been a while since Quentin has made a film, and he's certainly been dogged by some controversy about the way he worked with certain actresses, including Uma Thurman. What do we know about this film?
It's a big film with Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Margot Robbie, three of our biggest stars. And it takes place sort of adjacent to the Manson killings in Los Angeles. It seems to be somewhat more about these fictional characters, these sort of marginal Hollywood figures played by Pitt and DiCaprio. But Margot Robbie is cast as Sharon Tate. And so the question is exactly how is Tarantino going to engage with what went down?
Are there other directors or other films that you're actually looking forward to that might not be as familiar as Tarantino?
There's a lot. I mean, semi-familiar, but Almodovar, I've heard great things about his new movie. I'm curious about a couple movies. There's one called The Lighthouse with Robert Pattinson. It's by Robert Eggers, who did The Witch. One director I'm super excited to see in Cannes competition is Ira Sachs. He made a film called Frankie with Isabelle Huppert and Marissa Tomei. He is this American independent film director who makes these incredibly moving, small, touching films. And it's such a great idea to have him at Cannes.
It does feel like a lot of the directors who are at Cannes, either in or out of competition, are filmmakers who have been there for a number of years.
Yeah, that's kind of how Cannes works. It's why I think it's been the festival most resistant to diversity. And, you know, it's an interesting thing because ostensibly Cannes should have the most. It's, you know, the best of world cinema. And there's emerging auteurs and amazing, you know, filmmakers of all races coming from all over the place. But really, until Spike Lee was in the festival last year, it had been ages since I'd seen a film at Cannes in competition from an African-American director.
And it's worth noting that Black Klansman did win an Oscar for adapted screenplay, but it does feel that in the last couple of years, the Academy Award focus has really started around, you know, Labor Day with Venice, Telluride, and Toronto. Is Cannes really a player in the Oscars race anymore, or is it more by accident than design?
Certainly, when it comes to the foreign language race, just about everything you're going to see nominated for that Oscar is going to premiere at Cannes. But, you know, you mentioned Black Klansman winning an Oscar. It also was nominated for many and was nominated for Best Picture. I think the thing that's changing is if you've got a year-end release, you don't take it to Cannes because it's awfully hard to sort of restart the hype, you know, to appear in Cannes in May and then go dormant and then come back in November or December. We're not seeing that as much we used to with films like Carol. And I think there was the perception, or Inside Llewyn Davis, and there was the perception in both cases that maybe they might have done better to wait and launch and just sustain their momentum. But if you have a film like Black Klansman or Tarantino's film that are coming out this summer, well, what better place to launch?
Kyle Buchanan is the Carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times. Kyle, safe travels, or should I say bon voyage?
Bon voyage, I'll take it.
Coming up, actress Darcy Carden from NBC's The Good Place talks about persevering in Hollywood. When The Good Place debuted on NBC 3 seasons ago, Darcy Carden quickly became a fan favorite as Janet, the all-knowing Siri of the afterlife who has a human-like body. Carden recently wowed audiences and critics in the latest season, in which she played 2 different versions of Janet and 4 of her castmates, all in a single episode. While audiences might have fallen in love with Carden overnight, she studied improv comedy for more than a decade at the Upright Citizens Brigade, also known as UCB. When I sat down with Carden, she told me about another part she got just before landing The Good Place. Carden has a regular spot on Bill Hader's HBO series Barry as a fellow acting student named Natalie Greer.
Barry came about. I have a little bit of a weird history with Bill Hader, the creator, which is I babysat for him for many years in New York. So when his first daughter was born, they hired a babysitter and that babysitter was me. So I knew the family very well, but we just didn't quite ever cross that line. So he had been talking about Barry for a while. And then my manager said, we got an audition for you for this new show, Barry. And I was kind of like, oh boy, this is going to be weird. Like, this is not a great idea. Bill and I don't really mix career stuff with friendship. And I think it would maybe be smarter if I just said, like, I'll skip this. But then I read the pilot and it was so damn good. It was so good that I just thought, let me just go for it. And maybe I'll text Bill and say, let's not make this weird. Like, if you don't want me to be in it, just I'm fine with that. I've got a thick skin. I've been rejected 1.2 billion times. But then I did the audition and I felt it go really well in the room. And then I got a text from Bill like that night that he had watched the tape and it was basically done.
Wow.
I know, which was crazy.
And something else happens right around the same time, right?
So in this time, I mean, let me just remind you, I've auditioned for 100,000 things and you've never seen me on TV before Barry or The Good Place.
So what's happened? I mean, how do you think about that as an actor? You have auditioned for all of these things. You've studied, you've trained, you've done the work. What kind of mindset do you have to keep going and not say, okay, I'll do something else?
Right. I think because of UCB, I was so sort of like artistically satisfied that I got to do shows as many times a week as I wanted to. But I just was like, I had somehow come to terms with I wasn't going to sort of like live the dream that I had had for myself, but I'm still getting to do cool things. It's just not quite at the level that I was hoping for. And I think when I sort of was able to say, I'm okay, this is okay, this life is okay, I'm very happy, I get to do what I love. These auditions will come and go. I'll go to them because, you know, it's nice to like make a dollar here and there, but you're not going to get the thing that you thought you were going to get. I do think that that really put me at ease.
And after you audition for Barry and feel that it really goes well, right around that same time, Mike Schur meets with you,
yeah.
Correct?
So I auditioned for The Good Place, and that audition process took about a month. And in the span of that month, I also auditioned for Barry.
So when you go in, meet with Mike and get this part, what do you understand about what this show is about? Because there's also a big twist in the second season that you probably maybe don't even know about,
right,
when you start.
Yeah. There was nothing, no information out about this show when I auditioned for it. All I knew is Mike Schur was writing it, Ted Danson was cast in it, and Kristen Bell was cast in it. And that's really all I knew. And I got some weird audition sides.
Sides being a couple of pages from the show.
Yeah, and didn't know they were dummy sides, which means they weren't actually what was going to be in the show. I was like a helpful customer service rep that was helping someone on the phone. And I didn't find out that those were fake until I got the job. And then the day after I got the job, Mike called me into his office like I was like a bad student. He called me to his office and sort of explained what some of the show would look like and what my character was. And that's when he sort of said, Janet is basically like a walking, talking Siri, like an Alexa with a body.
And one of the challenges of a part like that is that acting is typically reacting to the way that other people are behaving. And yet your character, let's just say, has a limited ability to react.
Right.
And that fundamentally is a challenge as an actor. So how do you get there, and how do you work with Mike and the other people who are writing and directing on the show to get to a performance that doesn't feel robotic?
That's a great question. And that was my huge question when we started, which was, as an actor, I'm so programmed to react. That's like as important as any other skill we have as actors is reacting to what your fellow scene partner gives you. And it felt very like sort of stifling. It felt like I had to be aware of my face and it was hard. I don't want to spoil anything if you haven't watched it, but Janet does evolve and sort of change and things happen. So I didn't have to be stuck in that non-reacting thing for too long, but still, she is still not a human. So I just had to sort of figure out what her what her version of reacting was. And a lot of that is like a sort of weird smile. And I've sort of had to figure out like what Janet's version of a human brain would do. I mean, it doesn't make a ton of sense, but it does to me.
We're talking with Darcy Carden about her acting work on The Good Place and Barry. There's an episode that everybody's talking about called Janet's, and you get to play not one, not two, not three, but four of your castmates. I want to play a little bit from this episode.
Just because you don't remember doing something doesn't mean you didn't do it. I have no idea how it happened, but there is definitely a tattoo on my butt that says Jason. That brings us to Derek Parfit.
It does?
Parfit said, even if I have memories from an earlier time, that doesn't necessarily mean it was me. After all, if my brain was split in two and each half was put in a different person, which one is me? All I know is that other Chidi doesn't exist anymore, and this one does. So this must be the real Chidi. And all I know is that you're just barfing Wikipedia all over everyone to avoid talking about your feelings.
Oh my gosh.
When you get a script like that, yeah. I can imagine a variety of reactions. What was yours, and how did you go from what you were reading,
yeah,
and I suspect you read it before your castmates got, yeah, it, to what you actually did when you shot it?
It was funny. I was so flattered and honored, and Mike told me about it a few months before we did it, so I was ready. I knew it was coming, but the whole time that I knew it was coming, I felt like split between being so excited and so honored and really hoping that they decided not to do that episode. The idea was so exciting, but I just thought, like, it's not even the work. I mean, I love, like, the idea of having to dive into all that stuff was exciting to me, but I just, it was a lot of pressure to deliver something that the writers and Mike, they were very excited about. And that felt like, you almost forgetting that it's like going to be on TV for the world to see. It's so much about your cast and crew.
Well, it's not just for the world to see. It's for the actors that you're opposite, right, where you are imitating maybe behaviors that they don't recognize that they're doing. So in order to do it justice, do you actually look for specific things that maybe the actors don't notice they're doing? And is that uncomfortable even on a friendly level?
I think, the thing that was that I feared would be uncomfortable, which came true, is I didn't want to do them in front of them. But we did do one rehearsal where they were there. And oof, it was just like, it gives me the chills just to think about it. It was just like, you know, felt embarrassing to do Jamila's British accent in front of her, or, you know, any of their little weird quirks in front of them. But I have an amazing cast of incredible people, incredible actors, and they were so excited for me and excited for the story. So they were very willing to kind of give me whatever I needed. And if that was for them to be there, great. And if that was to go away, which is what I asked them to do, go far, far away, then they did that.
So even though this is obviously tightly scripted, and what you're doing in this episode has to be, you know, kind of blocked very carefully in terms of where you're moving and how you're looking, because there's a lot of digital work that has to be done about how you get multiple versions of yourself. Did you find that all of your improv training was actually really useful, even though it doesn't seem like a scene or an episode where improv is even relevant?
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's so much more to improv than just like coming up with words on the top of your head. It's like, it's also diving into characters really easily and finding small truths about characters and small things that differentiate them from a different character you played 30 seconds ago or whatever. So yeah, I definitely think that my decade plus of traipsing around on the improv stage like a loon helped me in this particular instance. And it was so much of it was technical, and so much of it was like making sure your hand is in the place where it was in the other scene. And it was a challenge in a different way than a normal acting scene would be. And I had Ted Danson in the first scene with me. He was the only other actor in a scene. So he got to sort of experience what it was like in this big, weird white room where we would set up these poles. I didn't do it. The crew would set up a pole with a piece of tape on the top, and the tape would be the eye line of the
other characters. So that you could at least pretend you were looking at somebody.
So Ted and I did a scene like that, and afterwards he took me aside and he was like, this is going to be very hard. He just was like, you need to remember what you're doing here, and it's going to be easy to sort of get too into the technical side of it or the rush, meaning like feeling rushed, like you need to get to the next thing or whatever. But he's like, you need to remember that you're acting and you're really playing these characters. And I was so worried that the story was being furthered and that these characters were growing and changing. I mean, this is like a really big, weird episode for these characters. And I didn't want me playing all of them to like lose that aspect of it. So I definitely think that a lot of my improv training helped with that particular episode. And kind of everything I do, every acting job I've had.
Coming up on The Frame, more with actress Darcy Carden. She talks about sticking to what you love, even through years of rejection. Let's get back to my conversation with Darcy Carden, who's captured audiences with her portrayal of Janet on NBC's The Good Place. We'll pick up the conversation with how Carden studied acting in college, but it wasn't until a fateful night in New York at the Upright Citizens Brigade that she found her true calling.
I went to see the show that a friend had recommended. We sat in the front row, and it was an improv show that had Amy Poehler and Seth Meyers was there and all the greats, like who I think of as like my comedy heroes, like Jason Mantzoukas and Brian Husky and all these, Jack McBrayer, all these amazing people. And it really was like a sort of the clouds part and like the sun shines on the stage. And I just was, my eyes were wide open and I was instantly obsessed. Like, I don't mean to say it was a religious experience, but I'm sure that when people are like, I saw Jesus or something.
It's like
I guess,
a chorus of angels.
Yes, and Amy Poehler was my I saw Jesus. And I just thought like, this is it. Like, I got to get up on that stage. There was a little bit of that. What? Like, I can, this is something that can be done? I did not know that, and I need to do that.
unlike what you had studied in school, which was
like straight
acting, yeah. But very different.
Yes,
obviously.
And I loved that. And you know, I did a ton of theater, and I loved it, and I still love it. But there was something that I connected with immediately when I watched that show, where it was like nothing had ever sort of spoke to me in that way.
I was thinking about a movie that Mike Birbiglia did 3 years ago called Don't Think Twice, is that it is inevitable that people in that improv troupe are going to succeed and some are going to fail. And it's almost like, you know, going to the pound and you're a puppy and somebody picks the other puppy and not you. Mm. And I'm wondering what it's like when you're with a group of people, some of whom might be getting career opportunities. What does that create within your mind as an actor when people are starting to get, you know, shots at the majors and you're maybe still doing shows at UCB?
Yeah, it's a weird mix, because the type of people that flock to improv are people that are going to be team players and people that are going to be really supportive. And UCB really cultivates that attitude. So when people started to sort of like pop, right? Like, I was like in class with Aubrey Plaza when she got cast on in a Judd Apatow movie and Parks and Rec, and, you know, things like that started happening. Zach Woods got on The Office. And at first it was so exciting. And because we're actors and we want to succeed, there's like a little bit of like, okay. But you tell yourself, like, there are countless parts. We will never run out of parts to be cast in. And then you start going like, okay, so great. So they got that and they got, okay, great. So another year of SNL went by. Okay, great. And you sort of start like counting and thinking maybe like you missed an opportunity. It can mess with you. It's not an easy career choice. And honestly, it's a dumb career choice. And you have to like really, oh my God, you have to love it. Otherwise, it's almost always just heartbreak and heartache and insecurity. But I feel really lucky to be a part of UCB in particular because of the way they sort of, there was like no room for jealousy in a way. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but it was just like, they're like trying to give you every outlet to be creative and to be seen. So you got to like put your head down and do the work and it will come to you.
We're talking with Darcy Carden. There's a story about something you were doing on Broad City where you didn't realize that you were being photographed and you assumed that what you were doing was not good. And it was like months.
Yeah.
What is that story and what did it teach you?
Broad City is created by two girls, Abby and Alana, that I came up at UCB with. Two of my best friends. I had dinner with them last night. Can you believe it? And they put me on their show.
This is Alana Glazer and
Abby Jacobson. I mean, it's a weird thing to go from stage to cameras. There's a lot of crossover, but there's things you sort of have to learn as you do it. And we had done a bunch of takes. I saw the camera. It was on the other actor. I was giving her whatever she needed, but I wasn't like really performing. I was saving it for my take. And then when we when the cameras were ready to move, Alana came over to me and she said, "Great job." And I was like, "Oh, well, thanks. I mean, I'll do it when the cameras are on me. I'll do it better." And she looked at me and she was like, "We're done. They were on you. We're moving to the next scene. You did it." Which was like, I was not ready. I was not prepared. It was a good, you know, I had to wait months and months and months until the show actually aired to see, okay, you were at least sort of doing it. And probably for the better. I mean, maybe if I thought the camera was on me, I would have really like overdone it. So maybe it was a lesson in subtlety for the camera. And just also truly a lesson in like being prepared and knowing exactly what's going on. And if I've learned anything from Kristen Bell, it's be a self-sufficient actor that knows what's going on a set, and it will help everything.
I want to ask you about failure, because I think people who are honest would say that they learn as much from failure as they do from success. And like many actors, you have been rejected and not gotten, I think by your account, 1.2 billion parts,
yeah, right,
that you wanted. What is the takeaway from that much rejection? And to other people who are like, I can't keep doing this. I can't keep hearing no. How do you make sure that that's not a referendum on you, and you continue to believe in what it is that you might be able to do?
It's so hard. You kind of learn these little self-preservation tricks. One of mine was the second I walked out of the audition room to tell myself, never think about this again. The only way you need to think about it is if you hear that you got it or you got a callback or something. But otherwise, don't worry about who gets cast in your place. Don't worry about how the movie does. It's not your business anymore. And also, it's an easy thing. It's all about like competition and who's got what you don't have. And if you can sort of get over that. There's nothing but negative from the competition aspect of it. And whatever you can do to yourself, whether it's therapy or exercise or whatever you need to do to sort of like clear your brain of that stuff, and just know that you have something special that you are going to give them. And sometimes that special thing is perfect for this particular role, and sometimes it's not, and it has nothing to do with you.
Darcy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Darcy Carden plays Janet on The Good Place, and Natalie on Barry. Both have been renewed for another season. And that is The Frame for this week. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here on Monday.